Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times. Now with goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. And you hear me say this every week, but it's true. Every week, you can catch the highlights from every Premier League game before anyone else, except for those people who are actually in the ground, simply by downloading the Times app to your smartphone. Also, if you enjoyed the Liverpool Live Show podcast last week, the second half of that show will be released later this week. And I have to tell you, it was myself, it was Tony Evans, Tony Barrett, and Peter Reid. I'd only met Peter Reid a few times before that. He is incredibly funny. He's got some great stories to tell. Seriously, Cass, you're smiling. He could do his own stand-up routine, couldn't he?
Yeah, I can remember you hammering him as well.
Hammering him as what?
No, just hammering when he was a manager. I can remember doing a show with you on the podcast.
Yeah,
and you going,
I would.
Peter Reid style of football, and this is a dinosaur, and all this.
I would much rather have Peter Reid entertaining me with stories of Maradona. And
I was going to say, did he tell you that he presumably told you about feeling like a tugboat chasing after Maradona? That's he's told me that one a few times, and I could hear it another 50.
It's a fantastic tale. That, getting him on Glenn Hoddle, getting him on Steve McMahon. Anyway, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, and I was able to generally understand most of what the three Scousers on the panel were saying. In the here and now, we have Julian Lorenz, Tony Cascarino, and down the line, it's Matt Dickinson. So let's get right into it. How about some FA Cup action with Manchester City and Wigan?
Fortuna. Headed away by Lescott, only as far as MacArthur, who's passed Timo Celis, who didn't make the tackle, and it's in for Perch, who makes it 2-0 right at the start of this second half. And the shock is on now.
Dick, I'm going to start with you. The magic of the FA Cup is dead. The romance is gone. Ha ha ha. The League Cup is so much better. Let me quote Ollie Kay a little more.
All it takes is one game like that to make us fall back in love, doesn't it? I mean, look, you know, the Cup, we've been around this argument a few times. Is that, you know, the football landscape changes and some things grow and expand and dominate and others suffer in that process. And the FA Cup has suffered in a few little ways, but when you have a game like that, it's just blinking fantastic, isn't it? And there's a way in which City sort of walked into it, you know, when you looked at that defence in particular. But it took Wigan, Rossler, to you know, whatever defence City put out, that was a fantastic achievement for Wigan and for Rossler, who has been admired for a while. And I know a few clubs have looked at him. I know when Derby appointed Steve McLaren, he was second on their list and highly rated, and he's been proving why.
Cass, I think this is pretty good. We have Wigan looking to make it two in a row. We have Arsenal looking to win their first trophy since the Middle Ages. We have Steve Bruce in a semi final and the whole City Tigers, and we have Cluffy, his son, admittedly, but still, are you moderately excited?
Yeah, I mean, got to say, a great weekend. I mean, Sheffield United's performance and a little bit of fear against Charlton in the first half, and then suddenly when they did get their noses in front, I think Wigan obviously was the outstanding performance, and sometimes we've just got to be honest and just go, hey, one team wanted it a little bit more. And the manager made some changes, okay, left some out. But that takes nothing away from what Wigan did in the game and the way they go about it. And let's be honest, last season's cup final, Wigan were unbelievably good. You know, they beat City fair and square and in a style that wasn't direct. It was about getting the ball down, move it quickly, and they were outstanding that particular game. It wasn't the biggest surprise, although obviously all the bookmakers and all of us in the media felt City send out their strongest team, which they didn't do, which I'm not quite sure why he wouldn't have.
Because they were playing Wigan, that's why.
Well, then you got your answer. Home. And, you know, Wigan have been in fine form. And if anyone had watched Wigan under Yuri Roslo in the last few weeks would have shown that, you know, that they've got something to offer. And they've got a few individuals that can cause you problems. And, hey, they wanted it a bit more. And I thought that was the outstanding difference between the two teams.
I'm just imagining myself being Sheikh Mansour. I've thrown bazillions at this team. I've also hired a proper director of football, Chiki Begiristein. And I've hired Manuel Pellegrini, who by and large has played good football and whatever else. He's gone into the season with Vincent Kompany, who's fantastic, if a little battle-worn. Mattia Nastasic, who's, what, 21? Mm. Martin De Michelis, snuff said, and we'll get back to him in a minute, I'm sure. And freaking Julian Lescott. And then you go and you spend $25 million or whatever it was on Jovetic. Do we detect an imbalance here? I mean, should somebody be made to pay for this? And maybe not necessarily the manager, but maybe the director of football, maybe you should find out what was your thinking.
Yeah, I think so. There's one thing that they seem not able to control is that complacency from those players, which I think has been their main...
Is it
main
complacency or are they just not that good?
For the last 3 years.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the central defender specifically,
yeah, I mean, yeah,
right?
Just to understand... I think they chased Eliakim Mangala, the very highly rated French...
But in January!
But even last summer, and I think they spent far too much time chasing him, when he was actually not really sure if he wanted to leave Porto. The release clause was quite high for someone like him with, you know, only 22, not much experience, blah, blah, blah. And I think they waited, and then it was too late. It was too late in January, it was too late last summer, and it's costing them now, that's for sure. And just to finish on the complacency, for the last three years, before Begiristein, with Mancini, Pellegrini, it's always the same problem. Some of those players don't care when they play games against smaller teams or lower league teams or whatever, and it's cost them so much as well again.
Dicko, is this fair, the not caring? And Cass, I want to get you, because it always makes me a bit uncomfortable when we accuse people of not caring. I look at somebody like Julian Lescott. I mean, my reading is that it's not a question of him not caring, it's a question of him not being that good.
Those players are not playing regularly because they are less good. In Richard's case and in Lescott's place, but the fact is that I guess also it's a fine balance between when you throw them in as a manager, you hope that, you know, this rare chance is going to invigorate, that they're going to come in and with so much to prove. But actually, I guess in certain cases, these are guys who are thinking, well, I've not got much future at the club. You know, who am I proving it to? I think they're now feeling sort of a bit alienated. So they're, you know, the psychology is sort of tipped the wrong way, and I think. We could see that in their defensive slackness, but also, as we say, we've seen, you know, Yaya Toure is one of those players who certainly can have days when he looks like it's a little beneath him, and as Julian quite rightly says, it is a pattern that we've seen at City and under the two managers, and clearly. Quite how he kicks that out of them. The psychology of kicking that out is a good managerial test that you know Pellegrini has changed quite a few things since Mancini. He's tried to be more inclusive. He's tried to not banish players to the margins in the way that Mancini did, and unnecessarily so. But he clearly hasn't quite tapped into whipping a fervour out of them. And there's a certain, obviously, Chelsea manager who remains better at that than his rivals.
Avram Grant, thanks you. Cass, can you just please help us understand? You played at a higher level than any of us, a far higher level. This whole not caring, this whole, like, psychological mindset. Hey, did you ever go to pitch when you really couldn't be bothered and said, I'm not going to put in any effort today because I don't care? Or did you ever see any teammates do that?
Yes, teammates, yes. Sometimes I've been guilty on the odd occasion. I've had my backside kicked for it. Don Howe questioned me when he was at Chelsea with Ian Portfield.
But did you genuinely not care on the day? Or
no,
was it just you were hungover or you were
No, sometimes, look, Gab, if you were to select a team like Man City yesterday, my first person on the team sheet in a game like that would have been James Milner. Why? Because James will never, ever let you down. And I think that comes from the manager. You're already sending a message out to what was required against Wigan. You know, they're all good players, but sometimes you... When I could see myself falling short of what I was meant to be doing, I got a lot of stick, and I got it from the terraces, and I got it from players who I was playing with. That then changed my mentality. Don Howe said to me at Cork Airport, I was injured and I went on the tour and I went out with the boys the night before we were leaving, after our last game. And he said to me in the morning, how hungry are you? And I went, I'm really hungry. He went, your contract's up in a year. He said, you went out last night, didn't you? And I said, well, yeah, I didn't play, but I had a couple of beers, Don, and I didn't. He said, why? Why was you out? You've got a lot to prove. You've had a couple of great moves. You've earned a lot of money in the last probably 2 or 3 years. Surely you should have something in your belly telling you that you're last chance saloon. And it made me think, because I think in football, sometimes you can get blasé, and success does bring failure in some levels, especially around finance. You know, once you've got that security of a great contract, and I think there's a little bit what Julian said about, say, someone like Yaya Toure, an incredible contract, no question he's a great player, and you could argue that about every City player. But there are certain people in dressing rooms that if they're allowed to be, and you don't keep the pressure on them, which certainly you could never accuse of a Mourinho's team doing, they will not quite give enough. And not quite give enough can be the difference, like it was for City against Wigan.
I remember a Man United player who may or may not be Gary Neville saying that Alex Ferguson always sort of wanted his defenders to be incredibly cold-minded, you know, good decision-makers above all. And De Michelis makes some for a very experienced guy, makes some very erratic decisions. You just put that, you sort of cobble that defence together, and instantly there's a wobble factor, isn't there?
Uwe Rosler, so he's at Brentford, he nearly gets promoted, suffers heartbreak, jumps it to Wigan, and he's hit the ground running. Do you like the way Wigan plays?
Well, I love watching them under Martinez, and when they got relegated, I thought they were one of the best teams I'd seen go down. Certain individuals like McManaman and then Maloney, I thought, were exceptional players for them. Emerson Boyce at the back, not the greatest defender, but gives absolutely everything. It was a strange one because Owen Coyle got it wrong, and I think Dave Whelan has to take a lot of credit because he recognised very quickly that it wasn't going to work under Owen Coyle. He could see they were underachieving, so he made a big decision on Uwe Rosler. And like you said, who had a big reputation. Matthew Benham at Brentford is no fool. There's no doubt about that. He's really done his work, and you can tell by how Brentford have done since Harvard, after Uwe.
Although they've done better since he left.
Yeah,
right?
But he's
picking. Maybe he was part of the problem, not part of the solution.
No, I think he knows, he recognises good managers who are good thinking. And I mean, look.
No, but I'm saying he leaves Brentford, and Brentford do even better without him.
Yeah, but I don't suspect there would have been a great difference from where they are. I think Uwe Rosler had done an amazing job at Brentford as well, and were very unfortunate last year, Gab. But what you've got is a manager that's seen what he's got. He hasn't tried to change them too much. They're a side that play to their maximum, I feel, when I've watched them. And, you know, you've got to say that I think Dave Whelan has done an amazing job selecting a guy that's seemingly turned the ship round very, very quickly from what that was the Wigan of last season. Which they weren't at the start of this season. They looked a completely different outfit from the team we saw go down. Now we seem to have turned it all back round. Now we see Wigan of what we saw last year.
Dicko, you don't get to see, obviously, as much of Wigan as some people do, but does it look to you like last year's Wigan? Compared to Martinez?
Well, I mean, there's been a bit of change in manpower, but I think the shape... He's as Tony says, he's harnessed what was good about the Martinez Wigan, and certainly what's left, given that he's lost a couple of key players. Everything I've heard about Rosler is that he's the sort of perfect sort of, well, not perfect, but he's just he straddles very well the sort of manager coach. You know, he's he can run a club. He's a bright guy, but who also works very well on the training pitch. Got some clear ideas. And works very well, you know, trying to improve individual players. So he straddles manager coach very neatly. And as I say, he was, you know, this wasn't the only job that he was considered for because of what he was starting to do at Brentford. And and everything about him. You know, he had a good reputation on a few clubs who were sort of looking at him and regarded him as sort of, you know, the guy on the rise that they were going to turn to next if they had a vacancy.
Santi Cazorla, Everton caught upfield here, and Arsenal on the counter attack. Rosicki, Ozil, Giroud, good night and thank you. Arsenal are safely delivered into the semi-finals.
All right, enough Wigan. Let's move on to the Emirates. Arsenal and Everton. There were some people who were all doom and gloom about the Gunners, and this was going to be another trophy-less season, and Giroud had, you know, gone off the rails, and Yaya was no good, and Ozil was done. Would you like some humble pie, Julien? Is Wenger somehow vindicated by this?
Let's wait a bit. It was a good win on Saturday. I was there, and I thought it was. I thought they played really well. It was a very good Everton team. The final score doesn't reflect really the way the game went, but I think they played really well. Ozil was much better. Giroud came on and made a difference as well. You know, it looked like, you know, if they don't win it this year, they would never win ever a trophy ever again, ever, ever, ever. So, but still, let's work with them psychologically. I still think that that team could struggle. You know, mentally, they're not as strong as they should be, and especially what happened.
That's a good question. So mentally, is not as strong, because we always talk about mental strength a lot of times. We can't explain things, but which team is mentally stronger apart from Chelsea? I'm assuming you're going to say Chelsea are mentally stronger than Arsenal. But apart from them, who else is mentally stronger, do you think, in the top six?
In the league, you mean?
Yeah,
I think a team like my issue with that this Arsenal team is the lack of leaders on that pitch. Imagine on Saturday that Everton went 2-1 up instead of Arsenal. I don't know who on that pitch would have picked up the team and give them the momentum back to come back in that game, for example. And that's my issue, and that's why I think mentally they're not as strong as Chelsea. You know, even City in a way, maybe not after yesterday, but you know, when they play, when the strongest team is on, and I do think they've got more characters in their team than Arsenal.
Dicko, did you have your Arsenal failure column already penned? And or, I mean.
No, I think, I mean, it's been a season that sort of threatened disaster before it even begun. Obviously, you know, it's turned out to be a whole lot better than those sort of doom-laden predictions before Ozil was signed and after the Villa defeat on the opening day, and just the general sort of undercurrent for the last few years. So it has this season, whatever happens, and it almost, as you say, looks odds on that it's going to finish with an Arsenal trophy, which in itself obviously will carry as much sort of symbolic significance as anything. You know, this is going to end up as a good season for Arsenal. Now, whether it's
if
they finish top four and have a trophy, then that's a heck of a lot better than last season or the season before that or the season before that. I think Julien is right to flag up that is absolutely no room for complacency. There's the Ozil signing itself. We're going to be able to argue long and hard about the 42 million, just, you know, whether he is produced full value for money. I think as Julien says, the leadership, the resilience in the top in the games against their championship rivals, how close they are actually to a really credible title tilt, especially because Chelsea are only going to get better when they sign a top striker. So, look, you know, it's definitely been a good year for Arsenal, especially as it seems likely they finish with the FA Cup. I don't think anyone can dispute that.
Cass, have they already won the FA Cup, given the way Dicko was talking? Is this a good year, or do you still go back to the fact that if you spent the money on another striker, maybe another centre-back to provide an alternative, you might actually be top of the league right now?
Mm. Their season is hanging on a really thin thread. And I mean that by, we're giving them the FA Cup. They've still got two games to get there and win it.
It's kind of disrespectful, isn't it?
Well, it's, and also, I don't trust this Arsenal team. As much as we can say they've had results, I don't trust them. And what Julien said and what Matt said, there's questions there. That, look, Man United have been awful this year. That's allowed Arsenal to be far higher than they should have been with the failings of United. City are a side that should be 10 points clear of Arsenal. And through, I feel... I look
Chelsea as well.
Oh, well, yeah. And I look at them and I think it's going to be a massive march for Arsenal. And if they didn't win the FA Cup and they just about make fourth place, I would have real serious reservations about Arsenal signing again a new contract, 3 year, whatever he's been offered, because I just feel that the Emirates is hanging really close to being a bad atmosphere. If you'd have been at the game with Bayern Munich, and they understood that they lost to a very good team, but this performance at Stoke and the way they played, Arsenal fans were furious with the way they'd gone about their business. And I don't really believe that we can look at a team that's going to achieve, you know, they could win the FA Cup by playing against sides that are far lesser sides than them themselves. But I wouldn't give it to them at all, because I'd still think that team, the core of that team, there's major question marks around whether they've got the character and the leadership. Because I don't see it on a week-to-week basis. I think they've had a lot of good performances, and when they are good, Arsenal shine and they can look exceptional. The game against Everton at the weekend was really close. It was so, so close, and ended up looking like a real clear victory, which it wasn't.
Well, and yeah, I mean, as Tony said, there's no case for sort of, I mean, you know, even if, you know, if they are at Wembley, they do lift a trophy, there's obviously there'll be triumphalism in that symbolic victory, but there's no room for complacency, and there's no room for sort of, you know, doing a great yah-boo to the world, because the fact is that that will just be a sort of a sign of one step back, and certainly an awful long way to go before, you know, I mean, we should be judging Arsenal by, you know, competing for the biggest prizes in the game, and they're a way off, still off the Premier League, never mind the Champions League.
Just to wrap this up, I need sort of a technical opinion here from you, Cass, because I've praised Gareth Barry all season. I think he's been a great bit of business. I thought they were very clever the way, you know, they got him basically for nothing. It's been a calming influence. And then I see that tackle. I'm just wondering, how does somebody at his age all of a sudden, like, you just get so uncoordinated and do something like that? And that really did change the game, didn't it?
I mean,
without that, we might be having a different conversation right now. Does it just happen sometimes? I mean, everybody makes mistakes, God forbid. But that's not the kind of mistake I would associate with Gareth Barry. I would associate Gareth Barry making a mistake where somebody runs past him and he can't catch him, or when he miscontrols a ball or something like that. I don't associate that kind of mental error with him.
Gab, he's made a few rash challenges, and you can sort of accept that sometimes happens in the game, but it was... How do I explain it? Because as I got older, yes, things became a little bit more difficult as I was playing the game. You'd make things, it's such a microsecond difference.
But is it fair to say that as you get older, you presumably make fewer mental mistakes and more mistakes because your body's just not as good?
Well,
right?
I found as I got older, one thing that stood out for me, I used my body far differently than I did when I was younger. And I always notice, and I don't want to generalise, but the Brazilians were incredible about using their body strength and how they could keep you away from the ball by just getting in the line of where the opponent was trying to get to. And I think as I got older, I got a bit smarter in not losing the ball, purely being able to protect it. But if you, obviously as the legs go slightly, if you get it slightly wrong, you can look, like you said, ungamely.
It seems like he lost his bearing. He didn't know where Oxlade Chamberlain was, where the ball was, where he was, which way the goal was.
Well, he was
just
very,
like,
afraid, Julian.
Yeah.
Because obviously Oxlade Chamberlain, a young kid, he's got an electric pace. He got a little bit frightened. He knew that he was in trouble. And with that, he's tried to get himself in a position to stop Oxlade Chamberlain get there. And then it looks like it did, you know, awkward. Yeah.
Moving on to our debate. We touched upon this last week, but we're delighted to have Dicko here to discuss this properly and not just Rory Smith. As you probably know, the FA created their own commission to go and help English football. It's a novel idea because they've never created commissions and committees like this before, and they've never had root and branch reviews or anything like that. Anyway, the Times decided to have their own commission. And I'm right, Dicko, you were one of the...
Call me Commissioner Dickinson from now on, please.
Exactly. We have Commissioner Dickinson, Assistant Commissioner Kay, and foot soldiers Matt Hughes and Rory K. Smith. Seriously, it's a really, I thought, really interesting, well-reported series of articles running from Friday of 2 weeks ago to Wednesday of last week. There's a whole YouTube, Google hangout with it. But, Dick, I want to take advantage of the fact that you're here with us. There were four broad suggestions that came out of it. I just want to go through them, get some input here. One of the suggestions is for the Football Association to double its annual investment in grassroots facilities to £24 million and to make increases in funding for coach education. Now, I was a little bit confused, Dicko, about this because I read the story and then it included the FA's response and they...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Say that they're spending more than $100 million, actually, on this. And no other football association in the world spends as much money as they do. So two questions for you. A, is this true? And B, if they're spending more than everybody else in the world, then maybe the problem isn't the amount of money they're spending, but the fact that they're hiring a bunch of numpties and incompetents.
Well, it's a big subject, but I mean, the main points to be made are that one, that there's a lack of municipal funding for, I mean, most pitches are owned by local councils, and that the funding for that is in their discretionary spend. So obviously when times are tough, and perhaps even when times aren't tough, the obvious thing to start cutting back is you know, do you actually put some half-decent dressing rooms on that council pitch, or do you just leave it to rot as it is? Do you go and build a nice new 3G pitch that's usable 24/7 and keeps our, you know, kids playing when it's the whole of Britain is waterlogged, or do you know, spend that money on something else? And obviously, a lot of the time, it's being spent on something else. So there is a sort of overall funding problem there. But to boil this down to football's issue, I mean, it's one of those things that we sort of know about, and then occasionally we do a series like this, and I think it's why it's so worthwhile. It reminds you of the just how sort of upside down the world can get sometimes. The FA have a turnover of around just over 300 million. Of that, they give about a third, which is about 100 million, my math tells me, to sort of back into the game. Now, of that, almost half, 43 million, goes to the professional game. An awful lot of it, obviously, through FA Cup prize money and broadcast fees and so on. Now, you know, it's one of those figures to say that's just sort of been there for some years now, and we sort of, I don't know, we just ignore it, forget about it. But you suddenly get sort of brought back to it and go, hang on a minute. So the FA, you know, which is there to fund the game and obviously to pay for the coach development and to nurture the grassroots, is giving an awful lot of money back to, you know, for example, if Arsenal do win the FA Cup, as we're talking about, Arsenal will take about 4 million quid of FA money. And at the same time, the FA puts only 12 million total into facilities, much needed facilities. Now, you say, that is clearly bonkers. Ian Watmore, a former FA chief executive, decided to sort of take on that figure, just say, hang on a minute, this is crazy. The professional game should not be taking this vast sum of much needed FA funds, and that explains why he lasted about 5 minutes in the building.
All right, so obviously, Julian, there's no counter-argument that if Arsenal didn't get £4 million for playing the FA Cup, that they would go and, oh, look, there's no money in it. We're not interested. We're going to go and we're going to play a bunch of those, like, numpties with French names that we've never heard of playing in the Arsenal.
No, that's
third.
True. For me, the grassroots problem in this country is about structure. My son is turning 5 in May. If, you know, we live in North London. If you want to find a club for him to play and train in midweek,
Barnet,
for example... Yeah, but yeah, I mean, if you want to, well, he trains in midweek and plays, you know, some little games to have fun on the weekend.
You strike me as one of the psycho athlete parents. Like, my son is turning 5. He needs a club to train. Like,
No. I'm just saying it's about structure.
Crazy.
No, it's about structure. In France, wherever you live, if you live in Paris, if you live rest in the country, you've got a club almost everywhere. Everywhere, in a small town, in a big town, in an arrondissement, in your neighborhood, you've got a club everywhere where you can start at 4. You train with usually your school friends or whatever. You play some little games, and then you go on when you're 6, 7, and then you start playing more competitive football later, and if you're good, then you get spotted by bigger clubs, and you go to an academy.
Julian, can I just this is a crucial point, isn't it? That those local clubs, I mean, and correct me if I'm horribly wrong, which is often the case, is that there is a lot more municipal setup and structure and funding and organisation around those clubs, isn't it? I mean, Britain has relied on this volunteer culture for decades now. That's the whole roots of our game. Whereas in France, Germany, and so on, there's a lot more municipal structure to the whole sporting system.
Here, the culture is different. You know, you play for your school. We don't play for your school in France. There's no football in our schools in France. You play for your local team.
There is a huge erosion of the state system, down to nothing in terms of sport in this country.
We all see the benefit of, I would hope, of kids doing sport in their spare time and having structures to do it. Cass, I want to know from you, though, how much does it really impact on the professional game? Because to me, there's a bit of a disconnect here, right? Where we talk about grassroots facilities and being as inclusive as possible. And you know, it's not just, let's face it, young boys are the ones who are going to play for England in the future. It's obviously also women. It's also, you know, overage people. It's physically challenged people. We all want these structures for them to go and do sport. But then we go and we judge the FA on how much England has won. Because I wrote a blog about this last week, one of the first questions, when I said, look, you guys really aren't doing that badly. And they're like, oh, when's the last time we won a major trophy? As if winning a major trophy means everything's fine with your system. And the reverse. I mean, is it really that important? Or should the money actually, rather than having a billion 3G pitches all over the place, you know, should the money be spent on taking like the top 1,000 footballers per age group in England and making sure that those guys are looked after if your goal is to produce more English players?
One of my biggest problems I've always felt is that there is this thing on numbers. We always have to have so many. If you look up clubs, and I mean, I hear all the time clubs are taking a huge amount of numbers of players just so someone else can't get them. And that's very common. I mean, I've looked at the academies and I've seen how they carry on. They only must play against other academy sides. And Gab, the biggest change in me, I think when I talk about football, I always think of things that I did in my career and things that I benefited. And obviously I played in France for 6 years and I saw, which I believe, and I still stay to this day, I saw kids playing the games on the pitches before matches. And I used to think, how unbelievably gifted they are at this age. I'm talking 9, 10, 11. Watch them regularly. I used to think they're so smart. And I might have been biased because now I'm there watching. I forgot how good kids can be in England.
Right.
But I did see a difference in technique, totally in technique. And one thing I've always said that I feel one thing we fail miserably on is our coaching. Not, I don't mean as a team, as taking a group training session. I don't believe we coach people individually, which I did to myself. And then I took a coach in Marseille, had a guy work with me, just me, all my strengths, worked on my weaknesses. And I think we haven't got there yet where we're going at a football club or even at youth level where we work on individuals instead of doing all one training session. I think we've got to try and get to the one-on-one situation, because you can put a team together, you can construct a team, but that's further down the line. I think one-on-one is the biggest difference I noticed in me, and I saw far more common in France than I did in England.
Amen. Amen to all that as well.
All right, the next suggestion here, the Premier League to tighten its, quote, homegrown players ruling, requiring each club to include a minimum of 10 homegrown players in a 25-man squad list. Right now it's 8, I believe, and to have at least 6.
See, it's all numbers, Gab. It's all numbers again.
Yeah, this is where, I mean,
I think this is kind of silly.
This is where I start to, far be it from me to distance myself from the
splitter
of my own newspaper, but, no, I mean, we kicked all this around, and this is, you know, why the debate is hopefully interesting, is that, you know, there are so many different views. I mean, I can understand the case for quotas, even if, you know, they can't be as prescriptive as because of EU rules about nationality, but I don't want to waste too much time on it. I actually think we need to concentrate on improving the standard of the players we have. We need to concentrate on why we don't produce, you know, the right type of players, why we don't produce number 10s, why we don't produce enough creative, daring players. So while I think there is a discussion has to be had about quotas, I regard it as sort of almost a desperate measure because we failed at everything else.
Might one of the... Go ahead.
I just want to add to what Matt said there. When we look and we look at certain positions, the number 10, how big and important the number 10 position has been in world football for all other countries. You tell me a number 10 that we've seen in England, we've gone, wow, that guy's going to be driven. That's going to drive the team forward. And I just don't see that.
We emphasise a certain type of playing the game, and it needs to be tipped and tilted to a different emphasis. That's the key. It's not about, you know, getting rid of something for the other. It's just about tilting the emphasis. I mean, Julian will back me up on this 100%. And, you know, this culture is right through every team. It's down at 8. It's even through the blinking press team. I mean, we go and the England press team plays foreign opponents. And as Julian knows from having weaved all around us, like the skillful player he is, even the English press team is rudimentary and basic and runs around very hard, and I'm very guilty of this, and does it with far less skill than every single one of our foreign opponents.
I have to agree with that. No, just on the number 10, I think Ross Barkley was outstanding on Saturday in the number 10 role just behind Lukaku. And I know Matt put a debate a bit on Twitter about Roy Hodgson would be completely stupid not to take him to Brazil, and I completely agree. And if he doesn't go to Brazil...
Rooney plays in that role.
Sorry?
But he doesn't do it very well. Does it, Gab, whenever you look at Rooney, he's ended up playing everywhere on the football field, not number 10. And he was allowed to do that in the last international. I was laughing as I'm watching the game. Thinking,
he has a free role. It's a modern game. Come on, lay off Roy. Come on.
But yeah, Ross is outstanding, and I'm sure I can find him a French grandma if he doesn't go to the World Cup of England.
Okay, I got to ask you about this next one, Dicko, because it sounds like something a politician might write.
In that case, I didn't write it.
A comprehensive review of the loan system and exploration of the possibilities raised by formal affiliations or partnerships between Premier League clubs and those in lower divisions to try to overcome the, quote, blockage, unquote, faced by young players after turning professional.
I can translate that if you like.
Yeah, basically he's talking about, let's go and talk about this some more and explore these possibilities.
It's basically talking about feeder clubs and obviously the loan system. It's basically asking the question of, A, the loan system is used and abused. You know, it's far more than it should be. There's too much of it, simple as that. And we also need to discuss the fact that the Premier League clubs, and not just the top few clubs, are pushing hard behind the scenes to see if they could be allowed some kind of feeder system. Now, Greg Dyke will not be the first FA chairman to knock down the pyramid structure. No, you know, he won't be that bold and brave. And you know, we have our 92 club system, and you know, we're going to keep it for the long foreseeable future. But is there a way? You know, we already know that Tottenham have a sort of understanding, shall we say, with Swindon Town, where they loan players to them. Is there a way that could be more formalised while keeping the loan system? Basically, it's one thing that this commission keeps coming back to, or ours and the FA's, is what happens when you have talented 16, 17, 18-year-olds and then they seem to struggle to get into the Premier League first teams. The Premier League first teams average 25, 26 years old. That actually number is actually going up. It's the blockage that we've been looking at, and obviously we're trying to work out whether the loan system, obviously, which works for some but fails for others. The feeder system, can it be done? And the Premier League are proposing this new Premier League 2, which will be an under-23 league, which they think will enhance the failing under-21 league and will act as the perfect bridge from the sort of academies to the first team. We need to work out whether that's just a rebranding exercise or whether it's serious.
I might suggest that this is beyond stupid, this Premier League 2 team, because all it would do is just increase the squad sizes of the biggest clubs. It would drive up costs. You know that they're just going to stock the under-23 team with a bunch of French guys and people from, you know, and as a result, a lot of good players who are getting their shot in the lower leagues on loan, perhaps, won't be getting them because they'll be playing in empty stadiums in the PL2. I think the loan system's fine. I'd like maybe explore other things like co-ownership.
Yeah, I mean, they love a loan in this country, don't they? You've got like a special loan window for the championship clubs.
But don't do it in one month. It's enough of this like 1 month loan. Like, why not have a season long loan?
Exactly.
Look at some form of co-ownership where you benefit based on the player's development. Inevitably, you'll loan players to clubs where you like the coaching staff or you have some affinity, right?
I completely agree with you. Those month loans are like weeks loans, stuff like it's just, I think it's ridiculous. And I don't know why is it, Dico, that they allowed, you know, the Premier League and even, you know, the Football League allows this kind of, you know, this kind of things. You can even go lower leagues and just, you know, just be on loan for two games or five games. It's just ridiculous.
Now, the last point is something that where I completely agree with Ollie Kay. A mid-season break for the Premier League made possible by scrapping FA Cup replays, two League Cup semifinals, and if necessary, considering reducing the league from 20 clubs to 18. I can tell you it is necessary. Reduce the league from 20 clubs to 18. Get rid of this other tripe and have a mid-season break. What say you, Dicko?
I agree with it, provided we are reducing the number of games. I mean, you can't have a mid-season break unless you are, because obviously you're just going to be cramming the same amount of fixtures into even less time. I'd personally, mid-season break will help, but you know, we just outlined, you know, these massive cultural problems that we've been talking about, and it doesn't make those go away. So it's you know, it may help slightly freshen up some of our players for a big tournament, but you know, it's a pretty small change when we're talking about the scale of problems that we discussed before.
And Julian, the great thing about a mid-season break is that it would allow clubs to go on tour and pursue more of those. Exactly. they continue to establish themselves as global brands, yeah, and then pursue all those lucrative opportunities in the Far East and the Gulf.
Exactly. I mean, you know, Boxing Day is magical, is all of that. It's brilliant. I like it. Everybody likes
it. But wouldn't it be much better to go and play a friendly against Al-Kharafa?
No, but you can still do Boxing Day. You can play on the 1st of Jan.
Play in Abu Dhabi.
And then get 3 weeks off in January. No one cares about January anyway.
Well, Gary Jacob can just fill the paper with transfer.
Exactly.
We can all go on holiday.
And a few clubs who are knocked out in the FA Cup early go there anyway for a week of training or something. So, you know, may as well do it properly. And
warm
weather
training, I think.
And it's compulsory. I think it's obviously necessary that the journalists should go out and report on warm weather training.
All right, enough of this. But you can go online, you can comment. I said, if you've got some time, it is actually pretty good. Ollie Kay moderates and presents and tries to keep Dicko and Rory Kay under control. So go check it out. All right, time for some quick hits. Hull City beat Sunderland to advance to a Wembley semi-final against Sheffield United, who overcome Charlton. Cass, you showed some love for Curtis Davis in your inquest. Yeah. Any shot he might get Hodgson's attention?
Probably too late. He wasn't in the 30-man squad.
But given how humdrum the England centre-halves are, why not?
He's certainly a far better player, a more accomplished player, Curtis Davis, than he was 2 or 3 years ago, where there was always, I always felt, a mistake in him. I thought his performance and... I looked at Steve Bruce and thought, I played with Brucey at Gillingham, and I saw him mature and get far better. The player he was at Gillingham, obviously, and he ended up at Old Trafford, and his ability to leap and head. I saw a bit of that in Curtis Davis. I thought he's in a side that really is a championship back four, but I thought he led it brilliantly against Sunderland, and I thought he's a real improving centre-half. And I tell you what, sometimes people get better in the latter ages or in the years in football, and I think he's one of them.
Speaking of Roy Hodgson, Dicko, what did you learn about England after their friendly with Denmark last Wednesday? And by the way, feel free to chime in on our campaign to get Curtis Davis in the England team.
Curtis Davis, I guess we're down to Corker and Dawson as a standby, so he could probably join that list. What did we learn? We learned that Lallana's not just on the plane but pushing hard for the team. We learned that Sturridge doesn't like it if he's moved away from number nine, and I think clearly he's thriving as a central striker, but you know, he's got to remember to a bit of versatility isn't harmful for a player. I think there was a massive overreaction to Rooney's poor first half. The idea I saw floated by a few of my colleagues that England should look beyond Rooney now, I found pretty daft, and I think we learned that Ashley Cole can't be written off just yet. I think there's a fascinating little three-way battle with him, Baines and Shaw. And to be honest, I think there are question marks against all of them, Baines included. And if I'm picking a squad tomorrow, I do not lightly jettison Ashley Cole.
Samuel Eto'o scores his 300th career goal at club level and impersonates an old man with lumbago as Chelsea defeats Spurs 4-0. Julian, you have 25 seconds to reflect on Samu's greatness.
I think at his age, because he's closer to 40 than to 30, actually, he's really good. And we saw how sharp he was on the first goal after the Vertonghen's mistake, for example. And maybe not at his best, obviously, and his best years are behind him, but still very, very, very useful striker and doing well for Chelsea.
Tim Sherwood mixes it up with Kyle Walker on the right wing, at least initially, Aaron Lennon through the middle, and not a single summer signing in the lineup. He says, quote, top fare ain't going to happen, and his players are gutless. Cass, do you sense a bit of a double standard when AVB said something less accusatory of his players? And also, what responsibility, if any, does Tim bear in all this?
A lot, because Tim's been given an opportunity, and I think initially took the job. He changed things quite dramatically and getting Adebayor in and played Soldado alongside him quite quickly. It's gone a little bit away from that at the moment. And I didn't quite get Lennon's role because I completely lost what he was trying to do on the pitch, Aaron Lennon, or what he's asked to do. Kyle Walker pushing him forward didn't suit him at all. But he struggled. It was a close game for a while, for probably just about half time. It was pretty even, although Chelsea did have some chances. Tim's never made a signing at a football club, and I now believe that Tottenham's probably the biggest reconstruction of the Premier League because, as you said, all the money, 93 million that was spent, no one was in the lineup. Yes, some injuries, and yes, some on international duty, but not to have anybody involved in the starting lineup says a lot where Tottenham are as a club.
Manchester United roll over West Brom 3-0. Dicko Davy Moyes sent a letter to season ticket holders thanking them for their support and urging them to have faith. Was this a sign of Moyes' strength or of Moyes' weakness?
I think it was probably a sign of sort of PS, please don't go bananas at me and the team if we lose some very big games coming up. I mean, the fact is that they have Liverpool at home, they have the return against Olympiacos, I think they have West Ham away and then City back at home, and those are four games that potentially could break Moyes. I don't think it will happen, I hope it doesn't happen, but you know, you just imagine how mutinous the mood could get if they're being outplayed and tonked at home by Liverpool and City and knocked out of the Champions League. I think that Olympiacos defeat, the way they played, it seemed to just sort of tip a lot of the fans. I think, you know, they'd been following Fergie's instructions to get behind Moyes. They'd been a bit patient, but I think just the manner of that defeat, certainly from the feedback I've had, basically strained the patience too far. And I think there's just some huge games coming up, and Moyes is just trying to buy himself a little bit more time.
Southampton win at Palace, and Adam Lallana steals the show. Julian, I think we can consider him an England regular now. Put him in context. If he were French, would he be going to the World Cup?
Oh, yeah, we would have him every day. I mean, he must be a bit French. He plays with too much flair to be English anyway. But
Lallana and Ribéry out wide, you like that?
Yeah, yeah, Benzema in the centre, Pogba behind. Yeah, I like that. But yeah,
actually, all you need is Pogba. You don't need anybody else.
True, maybe. But yeah, he's English, so you have him. So make the most of it. You know, start him and enjoy him, because I think he's a very special talent.
You just wonder why it took so long for people to notice.
Yeah. Gab, one for you. Major League Soccer kicked off this past weekend in the States. Are they excited?
They are excited. There's one of those polls, and by the way, this is another category people don't like, pollsters who use weird metrics to prove whatever they like, which shows that in the 12 to 21 age group, the game is actually more popular than baseball, supposedly, marginally. But the interesting thing is that all of a sudden they're spending some real cash. They spent a lot of money to get Clint Dempsey back. Obviously spent a lot of money on Michael Bradley. I suspect the way things are going with your mate Jose Altidore, they'll be spending maybe some money to get Jose Altidore back. It's a curious choice that clubs are making, but they do have some serious money, and it's obviously giving Defoe a lot of money as well. And you almost wonder if they aren't reaching some kind of tipping point. Thank you so much. You've been a tremendous audience. Thanks to my guests this week. It's Julian Lorenz. It's Tony Cascarino. And from beautiful downtown Mortlake, it's Matt Dickinson. Now, a quick reminder that you can download the second half of our special live show from Liverpool later this week. It has a strong Scouse contingent, and several of them, especially Peter Reid, are extremely funny. We're all on Twitter, so we'd love to hear from you. And we write back to each and every one of you individually. No, not really, but when we have time, we try to interact. Remember also the Times Goals app. It's the first place to see the goals unless you're actually at the games. So next week, bye-bye.
Your subscription to the Times and the Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Hi, I'm Tim Montgomery, the presenter of another Times podcast from the opinion pages called Did You Read? It's the perfect weekly snapshot of some of the best writing in the newspaper. Find out more by heading to thetimes.co.uk/commentcentral and search Did You Read to subscribe on iTunes.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.